For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. The Attorney General's office comes out in favor of a referendum petition to repeal tax increases to pay for raises to teachers, school support staff, and state workers. The Solicitor General says the state Supreme Court should accept the petition because otherwise it could jeopardize future referenda attempts for tax increases. Ryan, do you agree with this ruling?
It's almost like the Attorney General, Mike Hunter, has a very competitive Republican primary coming up in at the end of June. Wait a second. He does. He does have a very competitive primary, and he's having to contend in a Republican primary electorate that I think that he is either calculating or maybe has some polling that suggests that this is a popular issue among the folks that he anticipates being at the polls. And if he were to do anything other than what he's done right now, which is to come out and say that this is the ballot question is sufficient and should move forward, he would be handing a political issue on a silver platter to Gittner Drummond, his political opponent, who is already slamming him for being a Washington lobbyist. And I think what Mike Hunter has done here is he's made a political decision. He is a political operative. He understands how this stuff works. Legally, I think that his case here doesn't hold any water, and I don't think it's going to hold water with the Supreme Court. The referendum is insufficient on a number of fronts. It is sloppy. I mean, just legally sloppy. I can't believe that anybody would put their name to this and say that this is the referendum we're going to put forward to challenge this. It's like they did it on the back of a napkin and then went and turned it in. If nothing else, one of the things that they failed to do was attach a correct copy of the piece of legislation that they're seeking to overturn, let alone all of the confusion. But they didn't even attach the right copy of the bill. It didn't include section numbers. That's easy. And by failing to do that, I think that they have doomed this before the Supreme Court, regardless of what the Attorney General is arguing right now.
Neva.
Well, I mean, I guess we have to back up and look at what really happened. I mean, the Supreme Court asked the Attorney General's office to provide its views as a neutral party to the issues that had been presented. And I think what they basically said was that in their view that the teacher pay raise would not be affected regardless of what happened with respect to the referendum. So, I think they did their job as the Attorney General's office. They were asked to provide information. They provided it. It appeared, at least at first glance, as fairly comprehensive from a non-lawyer point of view myself. I think to try to politicize that and say that everything that or anything else that's being done in the AG's office right now, even though there is a campaign taking place and a June 26 primary very closely coming up, I think is really disrespecting the office and is really I don't think is warranted.
And it also came up from the Solicitor General. The Attorney General did not do any kind of press announcement or anything like this. Came from the Solicitor General. So it seemed at first, when I first glanced saw it, that it was not, didn't seem very political because he didn't come out and say something.
Well, and I think that it wasn't that he was trying to take an affirmative position and make political hay of this. I think he was trying to rob Gittner Drummond of a political issue. And Eva's right, he didn't want to weigh in on this. I think that if he'd had his choice, A.G. Hunter would have just rather let this issue be in front of the court, let it go there to be a decision up or down, and for him to move on and do something else. I think that, you know, there was probably this, come on, guys, really, you're going to make me have to say something about this in the middle of this primary season? And there's, you know, the time frame is what it is. The court has their hearing set on this. You know, there was no other choice, that, you know, in terms of timing. I don't think that they tried to sabotage the Attorney General here. But I do think that the context of the brief that he submitted to the court, I think the arguments that they're making just don't hold a lot of water and, to me, make a lot more political sense than they do legal sense.
Well, the other point that I think in the documentation that the Attorney General's office said was that the referendum petition's technical deficiencies really didn't merit invalidating the process at that point and the vote. And so I think they were taking a cursory look, doing what they were asked to do. June 11th, the Supreme Court will come in. They will hear these arguments and make a decision. And I think this is just anyone in political office having to deal with doing their job and continuing to move forward, being very professional in the service to the state, while also being a candidate on a ballot. I mean, that is always a dicey proposition, but I do think cast any discredit or aspersions on the Attorney General is absolutely not warranted.
It took only one thing kind of into account, and that was the argument that it was the emergency clause of the teacher pay raise. So there are other reasons why this could be struck down by the Supreme Court.
And I think that the emergency clause is the weakest argument, and that's the argument that's been raised by APOE, the Association of Professional Educators. That, to me, is the weakest legal argument and challenge of the referendum. I think that the confusion...
You'd mentioned more that we're probably...
Yeah, I think that the confusion around the gist of the petition, I think that the issue regarding the failure to comply with attaching a true and correct copy of the legislation being challenged, you know, that's where I see the most successful challenge being mounted here. And I think that that's where the court will ultimately say that the folks that are going to the people collecting the signatures did not do their due diligence. And Eva's right. You know, normally, you know, on things like this, the court will say, we're not going to let a technical omission stand in the way of the powerful power reserved to the people of Oklahoma by our Constitution to have a referendum on legislative actions. That's a powerful power that people of Oklahoma have, and one that I defend. But there is requirement that you have to have some sort of substantial compliance, and to attach a copy that doesn't even reference the section numbers, that creates an issue where if voters think that if they approve it, that it invalidates something, or if they vote against it, that it sustains it. You know, those things are important, and you know, I think that they go beyond a technical misstep on the part of the petitioners. I think that it's a failure that's going to be fatal to the petition itself.
Going to stay on the Attorney General, there's a battle, of course, brewing in the Republican candidates over the television airwaves. Incumbent AG Mike Hunter wants to TV stations to pull ads from challenger Gettner Drummond because Hunter says they are deliberate lies. Meanwhile, Drummond is demanding the same, saying Hunter's ads are misleading and false. Neva, this seems to be a pretty intense battle for a primary and an attorney general.
I think it absolutely has become, at this moment, the most intense battle among the Republican primaries at the statewide level. It's dueling airwaves. I mean, it is partially because you have two candidates with the funding capacity to be able to get on the airwaves and be able to really kind of start swinging at each other. And I think that the fact that we're seeing this still 3 weeks out from the primary says that it's going to not only continue to be a very contested, heated race, but we haven't seen the last flurry back and forth, you know, certainly between these two camps. So I think that it's not uncommon. I mean, you take your best shots, you take your best information that you believe provides a contrast to your opponent. I mean, nothing new. The voters ultimately will have to see how they respond and what they believe and whether it really starts to kind of change the political landscape in this particular race, and it's going to be fascinating to watch.
I haven't seen anything this heated in the GOP primary since the state superintendent race about 4 years ago against Jenna Barisi.
Well, and I think that I think everybody walked into this election cycle thinking that you have this very crowded Republican primary to be the gubernatorial nominee, the Republican candidate for governor, and that's what we really haven't seen a lot there. I mean, those have largely been positive ads. I'm Mick Cornett, or I'm right. Todd Lamb. I used to be in the Secret Service. I, you know, did all these wonderful things for Oklahoma City. I'm Todd, you know, all of these things, right? Everybody's being very positive, trying to get name ID out. That race is a race to get into the runoff. In the AG race, there is no runoff. This is it. Sudden death, winner take all. And they're playing like that, you know, that this is the last few minutes of the game. And I think Neva's right. As this goes on, it's only going to get more and more heated. And, you know, I think that it's going to be difficult for the Attorney General to get anybody to pull these ads. And I think the same for Gettner Drummond. You know, when these folks step out onto the public stage, the First Amendment protects a lot of political speech. You know, the latitude that you have with regard to political speech against a public official is pretty large, and rightfully so. So, you know, one of the attacks against Mike Hunter right now is that he, you know, directed money from a PAC that he was oversaw to Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, which is, you know, about the worst thing that you can say about somebody in a Republican primary. I mean, them's fighting words. And, you know, so, you know, technically he was part of this pack. He was leadership there. He's saying, I wasn't the one who directed that. And, you know, Drummond's campaign, led by a guy named Trevor Worthen, who's a former House member that I served with, he's saying, well, you know, he was part of the pack. The money went there. And, you know, if A.G. Hunter tried to challenge that in a court, they'd say, listen, this is protected speech. Yeah. You know, you get to say that. And I think that, you know, both of these candidates want airwaves to be wary of airing them and thinking that they may be subject to litigation. But the lawyers at those radio stations and TV stations, they know better. These things are going to continue to get aired. And those radio stations and the TV ad buyers are still going to get paid.
Yeah, and the Oklahoman on Thursday morning even came out with an opinion basically telling Gettner Drummond, you're attacking the First Amendment. You might want to read the Constitution before you start doing that. So. An initiative petition to have voters decide on putting optometrists in big box stores like Walmart gets enough signatures to go before voters this November. Supporters say it provides opportunities for shoppers, but opponents say it's a power grab by Walmart to increase profits. Ryan, what do you think of State Question 793?
I think, you know, it's really interesting. And to, we haven't really seen the political partisan lines divide up on this yet. You know, this, you know, oftentimes state questions become referendums in political campaigns. And, you know, the Optometrist Association, you know, for the longest time, their biggest political enemy in the state were ophthalmologists. And you've seen ophthalmologists and optometrists fight one another over scope of practice turf wars of the legislature for over a decade plus now, over who gets to do what and who is exclusive to particular procedures or whatever it is. And now we're seeing optometrists up against these big box stores. And that's an interesting political fight. You know, I think that it would be a different fight if we were in a situation where everybody just, if they needed eyeglasses, got to have eyeglasses. If, you know, imagine that. If, you know, but I think in some rural areas, it gets increasingly hard for people to find access to healthcare providers of any variety.
Certainly
specialists. And to be able to walk into a big box store, get an eye exam, get some cheap glasses, be able to see, you know, that's important for a lot of folks. And I get that optometrists want to be able to protect their businesses. But at the same time, I'm wondering if this is not the hill for them to die on. I mean, we've already seen, you know, the online industry, groups like Warby Parker that have really walked in and said, we're going to provide inexpensive eyeglasses that are at a very discounted rate of what you get whenever you go to your optometrist.
Neva.
Well, you know, I thought it was interesting that needing 255,000 signatures, they needed 123,000 signatures and got 255,000. I mean, that's impressive, right on the front end when you start talking about organizing for a state question. So clearly, this is going to be one of those that while the voters have a long time till November to really begin to kind of look at both sides of the argument, when you look at the groups, I mean, when you think about the silver-haired legislature and the fact that they, for a long time, have advocated going this direction to the legislature, pushing them to do that unsuccessfully, and the fact that they, by their own admission, say that their numbers, they represent 850,000 silver-haired Oklahomans. That becomes, I mean, in the scope of what you're saying, Ryan, the voters who will be most interested in hearing the arguments, most interested in knowing if this is an opportunity for them to save money or not, is it going to be a good deal or not, is it just a power grab by Walmart, as you say, Michael. I mean, those are the things that, again, I think will be probably some pretty interesting advertising and commercials that we'll see in the fall that will try to frame this up on both sides, and it'll be fascinating to see if it becomes a demographic where the older voters weigh in and become a real significant factor in whether this passes or fails.
And younger voters are used to buying glasses online. The number of Oklahomans that have walked into an optometrist, and I love my optometrist in Seminole. I still go see my guy in Seminole, Oklahoma. And, you know, but whenever they walk in, first of all, your vision insurance is not standard for a lot of folks.
Right.
You walk in and you get an eye exam, and then you go and you try to buy some frames. And, you know, sure, there are some inexpensive frames out there, but people will soon find out that they have a lot of out-of-pocket cost there. So a political argument of saying we want to limit consumer choice is never – it's a really difficult political argument in any context, and whether it's eyeglasses or anything.
And it's the consumer choice balanced by the medical side of it. I mean, the optometrist will tell you, I mean, in these small communities, if they continue to be eroded in terms of what they can bring in terms of a patient coming in, needing eyeglasses, getting that prescription filled, with their optometrist as opposed to going down the street to a Walmart or something else, that the impact in these, particularly in the rural communities, I think it may be more pronounced even than in the metropolitan areas, and obviously where a bigger percentage of our senior, you know, senior Oklahomans are living, that makes for a very valid conversation that I think is going to be infused into this debate as we get into the fall and try to balance off what the good and the bad, the pros and the cons are for this state question.
And that's a really legitimate argument. I, you know, like I said, I go see my optometrist, mm-hmm. and some, like, continuity of care is important. And sure. Are you going to have that continuity of care at a big box retailer? Probably not. And, you know, so I think that, and if big box retailer has it up and they shut down the small guys, and we see that with a lot of independent pharmacies, you know, that's going to be, I mean, but
that's an argument they can certainly use.
That's an argument they can use, but that's a very difficult argument to make whenever voters are being presented with an option of increased consumer choice, lower prices, greater access. And, you know, you've got to come in and make this argument about why it's important that these institutions, even if there is a premium placed on some of the services they provide, are incredibly important for those communities. That's a tough argument. And I don't know that they're going to be able to make it.
And I think that's the interesting argument when you really look at a lot of these healthcare type issues, whether it's on the pharmacy side, whether it's the optometry side, some of the issues being discussed even on the other
on nursing and the medical sides.
I mean, it raises some big issues that I think have long range consequences. That sometimes it seems like the short take is, hey, I'm going to save a few dollars today, but what's the consequence for the future?
Yeah. A story in the Tulsa World raises concerns, and in the Oklahoman on a Thursday morning, raises concerns about polling places. The major problem is the people who run them are getting older and dropping out of volunteering. Tulsa County, for example, has 262 precincts, and each of them must have at least three officials to work 12 to 15 hours on election day. Neva, this could eventually be just as big a problem as voter turnout itself.
It is, and it, again, like we talked about last week, when we look at some of these issues, they are national issues. I mean, 65% of all of the jurisdictions across the country 2 years ago during the elections said they were experiencing problems being able to adequately fill every polling place with the number of prescribed people that they needed. I mean, in Oklahoma, whether it's three per polling location or whatever it happens to be. So when you have really, I think the statistics show that more than a quarter of the folks that work the polls are seniors, people that are retired, that are, you know, have the flexibility to be able to put those days on their schedule and be able to show up and work 15 hours for, you know, basically a fairly minimum amount of money. But I think the bigger takeaway I see on this is what a lot of states are looking at, and I think Oklahoma should as well, is the idea that that you really go and try to capture college-age students, even high school voting-age students, and try to recruit them into the process. And in some states, they've been very successful in these programs that really were kind of initiated by Congress several years ago, trying to really address this in kind of an overarching way, in incentivizing folks to take a look at this. So I think we've got to think outside the box. We can't just go back to our go-to folks that have always done it for years and years and years, because they are becoming fewer and fewer. And I think we need to, as a state, be very proactive in trying to address this and not just talk about it, but actually get something done.
One was like 100 years old. She said, I can't do this anymore.
I'm tired, he said.
I think of, you know, some of the precinct workers that I've known over the years. You know, they're either very elderly or they've passed away at this point. And it's one of the greatest pieces of public service that you can offer to your community, to participate in that democratic process, to be somebody that's going to oversee. And when we talk about the integrity of our elections, these are the folks that are on the ground. And we've made their jobs harder. And, you know, this is something that the ACLU, every election, we're doing voter protection, and we get complaints from voters who have gone into a polling place, and now with new voter ID requirements, and, you know, when do you get a provisional ballot? You know, if you're an independent and you're trying to vote in a Democratic primary, but they don't tell you that you get to vote, you know, that's not because these poll workers aren't necessarily nefarious people and they're trying to subvert people's ability to participate in the process. The rules change, and, you know, now the rules are more complicated than ever. And so you've got folks that it used to be you tell them your name and they give you a ballot and you sign an oath an affirmation that says that I am who I am under penalty of law, that I am entitled to a ballot for this particular election. But now it's, I've got to see your ID. I've got to make sure that there's substantial compliance between your ID and the registration information that we've got here. If you don't have that, I have to give you this provisional ballot. And those provisional ballots, they're not easy. And so you've got to go through this entire new affidavit process. It's difficult work. And I think Neva is absolutely right. We need to incentivize this, maybe increase the pay, go out and recruit. I love the idea of recruiting younger folks to get out there and be in these polling places and to see how elections work. I think if more Americans watched how that election process worked on election day, they'd have more confidence in the election process. And then as a state, there are other things that we can do, again, by eliminating some of the load on election day. Election days are incredibly stressful, long lines in some of these precincts. If we had vote by mail, if we had a voting period that lasted over 2 weeks instead of, you know, a day or maybe some extended period with federal elections, mm-hmm. and then encouraging people to fill out absentee ballots to reduce that load on precinct workers.
Well, we also saw that where Tulsa and Oklahoma City are closing their schools, maybe some teachers could actually volunteer to go. I mean, it's just if you walked into a polling place and saw your teacher there, maybe you'd think a little differently about how you're going to vote. Okay, so the incumbent, the incoming Senate President Pro Tem Greg Treat picks his new leadership team. While that's not unusual, there is one major historical thing to mention. Just a few weeks after Democrats picked Oklahoma City Senator Kay Floyd as the first female leader of any party in the Senate, Treat has tapped Senator Kim David, who just finished her time as the first female appropriations chair, to now be the first female majority floor leader. Neva, your thoughts on this pick?
Well, I think it's a wonderful, and I think it is long overdue that we're seeing women who have been serving in the legislature now coming to the point where they are in major leadership positions. And, you know, and I look forward to the day that we have the first female Speaker of the House or the Senate pro tem. But Kim David certainly has had a strong legislative career, and I think the fact that she just chaired, as you say, the Appropriations Committee, that makes her well positioned. She understands some of the most critical facets of the process, has been there long enough to really be effective, and I think as majority floor leader, she'll be a tremendous asset to Senate Pro Tem Treat. And I think when you look at the person who succeeds her on the Appropriations Committee with Roger Thompson, I think, again, you have someone who brings some expertise, brings some passion to really looking at these budgets, really dealing with the numbers and crunching them, and I think his colleagues have a great deal of respect for his ability. So I say at the outset, it looks like they're starting with a very strong team that they can build off of and prepare themselves for next February.
Ryan.
Yeah, I think it's a solid pick. And to think about, you know, Senator Kay Floyd and Senator David, you know, working together to craft what's happening on the legislative floor between the minority and the majority caucuses in the Senate, that's an incredible day for the state of Oklahoma. And you know, I think that even in that adversarial relationship, they're still going to be able to work together in a very positive way. They've got a strong track record of already doing that. And, you know, I think back when I came into the House and in 2004, you know, on election night, you know, it was clear that the Democrats had lost the majority, we were seven House district seats away from Jerry Askins, Lieutenant Governor Jerry Askins, from becoming the first female Speaker of the House in the state of Oklahoma. And, you know, she did go on to become leader of the Democratic Caucus and served in that position in a wonderful capacity for 2 years. I was fortunate to be able to serve with her and under her as leader of the Democratic Caucus during that time. And, you know, with Roger Thompson, Senator Thompson now, the appropriations chair, one of the things that I really like about him is that he stood up this legislative session and carried the most bold criminal justice reform measure that was proposed in the state legislature this session. It would have made State Question 780 retroactive. It would have saved the state around $10 million. You know, that bill didn't even get a hearing in the state Senate. I've got to bet that as a champion for criminal justice reform, as chairman of the appropriations, especially with bills like that have such a huge positive fiscal impact on our state's budget, that we're going to see some movement on criminal justice reform this upcoming session with him as chairman of appropriations.
Now, Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.